You know how to write?
Okay, good morning, everyone. Good to see you today.
Oh, I forgot. You went from...
It's good to see so many of you back again. And there are going to be two sheets going around, two different sets of words to the last two songs that we're going to listen to from Considering Matthew Shepard today. We've been talking all week about reforming ways of reading the Bible in the wake of the Lutheran Reformation. We've talked about things that are good about the way Luther encouraged his followers to read the Bible, ways in which that focused us or encouraged us to grapple with the Bible in the concrete, to learn more about the original languages, to pay more attention to its original historical context. But we have also talked about ways in which Luther kind of closed the door on this ever-expanding multiplicity of meanings that ancient and medieval interpreters found in the Bible, and tended to think of biblical meaning not only in sort of unitary or singular terms, but also in very objective terms that don't really think about how reading the Bible shapes me, how it affects me, how it transforms me, and how it calls me to specific forms of moral action. So those are things that we've wanted to kind of reclaim as we've thought about the Bible and about what theology that sort of models itself on the Bible can be throughout this week. How many of you are here for the very first time today? So welcome. I have a couple of people who are here for the first time. Obviously, we're sort of wrapping up a discussion that's going on, that's been going on all week, but we're really happy to have you here. Is there anyone who's attended all five sessions now? Wow, so you all get the gold stars for the week. But I know a number of you have been coming in and out and have had other commitments here at the Village, but I've been really, really honored to be with you all week, and it's been a really great experience for me. Just to review a little bit what we talked about last time. Last time we really faced some difficult but I think important material, and I think had some good conversations about it as we thought about what it means to really force ourselves to look at scenes and realities of injustice that we often would rather look away from. I was thinking there's a sense in which, like, one way we could define that word privilege we use a lot, like white privilege or economic privilege or male privilege or whatever sort of privilege you want to talk about, is the freedom to look away from tragedy, the freedom to look away from injustice. And not everybody on earth has that freedom, right? But many of us here at Holden Village, I think, do have that freedom. And what does it mean to allow the Bible and allow works like Considering Matthew Shepard to kind of reorient our gaze towards those things we'd rather not look at? One effect of that, I think, is that seeing one injustice leads us to look at more injustices. It doesn't lead us to stop with one, but even when we were talking about Considering Matthew Shepard, we talked about this one hate crime, but we also talked about the larger realities that many of us have experienced of hate against the LGBTQ community. We talked last time about the anti-Semitism in Lutheran history and with Bach specifically. When we heard those words, Kreuziger, in the piece from Considering Matthew Shepard, we related that to the horrors of Nazi Germany, right? And then we talked about James Cone's book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree, which I had put on the recommended reading list, we talked about the ways in which forcing ourselves to remember and to learn about and to see those horrific stories of lynching, it encouraged us to look at different works of art, right? So we looked at works of art by so many different black artists of the Harlem Renaissance, like W.E.B. Du Bois and Count Te Cohen and Hale Woodruff and many others. And then we also connected it to the realities all around us today, right? With these horrific police shootings that just repeat themselves again and again and again in people like Freddie Gray and Michael Brown and Eric Gardner and Tamir Rice and Sandra Bland, Stefan Clark, and so many others, right? So this is one way in which I think if contemplating the cross leads us to these sort of ever multiplying visions. It's different from a kind of traditional Lutheran way of thinking about the cross, at least one side of that, because so often Luther wanted to talk about the singleness of biblical meaning, right? Like you see the cross and you get an answer, right? You see the cross and you believe the right doctrine. And here it's just the opposite. We look at this one story that's at the heart of the Christian tradition of unjust killing, true tragedy, injustice seeming to prevail. And the more we look at that, the more we're called to confront the realities in our world that we would rather turn away from. And I think it's not just a matter of sort of opening our eyes to them, but as we talked about last time, if we really open our eyes to these realities all around us, it's going to transform how we act and how we live. So it's going to call us to become activists on behalf of racial justice, on behalf of economic justice, and on behalf of environmental justice. I was thinking last night, there's this long history in medieval Christianity of distinguishing between the via contemplativa, the way of contemplation, which some monastics chose, which was to basically cloister yourself, devote your life entirely to prayer, live in the confines of the monastery, and then this other life, which was also a monastic life, but the via activa, the active life, and those would be the monks that were out in the world serving the poor, caring for the sick, all of those sorts of things. And I think that this other sort of contemplation that we've sort of been wrestling with as we've tried to kind of combine the best insights of those ancient and medieval interpreters with the best insights of Luther himself is one that kind of collapses this distinction between the active life and the contemplative life. One that encourages us to think that the more we open our eyes to the ways God is revealed in the concrete world around us, the more we open our eyes to the way God is revealed in suffering, the more we're going to become engaged in the world and work to transform the world and work to resist those sorts of injustices that sadly still surround us every day. So those are the sorts of themes we discussed last time. Today we're going to be having one more reflection on allegory, which we've seen has been sort of a touchy subject in Lutheran traditions. Luther was very wary of allegory, even though it's central, as we saw a couple days ago, to Luther's very favorite book of the Bible, the Letter to the Galatians, where Paul himself gives an allegorical reading of the story of Hagar and Sarah. But I also today want to be sensitive to what Luther's concerns about allegory were. And I think one way to help us with that is to listen to one of the early songs in Considering Matthew Shepard that we haven't listened to yet. And this is going to be, I think it's the second track in the entire choral work here. And in this track, Craig Hella Johnson is going to encourage us to focus on Matthew Shepard not as a symbol, not as an idea, not as an abstraction, but as a human being, an ordinary boy, as he's going to say again and again, who liked ordinary things, who did ordinary things, and really could have been each of us. Okay, so let's start by listening to this and see what strikes you as you listen to this song in a contemplative way. we're into the next track there now. I heard Craig Keller Johnson interviewed once, and he said that as he worked on this piece for over a decade, and that as he was working on it, there was a point where he reached a kind of writer's block and didn't really know where to go next, and it was writing this piece that kind of got him back on track. Why do you think this was so important to him, or what struck you listening to this piece?
Well, everything he loved was just, he was ordinary, mm-hmm. you know.
So it could have been
and
me?
Yes, so, right. Yeah, any of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, okay.
Describing him as ordinary, so like anyone of us, the whole song is all about particularizing him. He's not just a symbol of gay rights, he is somebody like pasta and jogging, and had tastes that maybe I don't have. He's his own person, he needs to be seen as a whole human being in his own rights.
Good.
With some, extraordinary stuff at the end too, right? You want him to both be ordinary and also see the specialness, the individuality of him, and the way he is like everybody else, anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was no threat to anyone.
Mm, yeah, he seems pretty likable here, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Not a pest. Yes. Yeah. Well, and it is very easy to make a kind of abstraction out of Matthew Shepard because, as I mentioned earlier in the week, his name is now on many laws. Like the Matthew Shepard Act is a federal law that defines a hate crime and increases mm-hmm. penalties for crimes when they're classified as a hate crime. But, I mean, that line from his mother is so powerful. You knew him as Matthew. To me, he was Matt.
Yeah,
were you going to say
something?
They
also have scholarships for his name, because I administered not that one, but once I came into university, and that was one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, so as the song says, his name came to be known around the world, and it came to represent so much. And I guess that's a good thing that it did, right? But at the same time, this song is calling us back to realize we're talking about a real human being, a particular, specific, concrete human being who was unique in his own ways and also ordinary the way we're all ordinary. Okay, so I think for me, this the way this relates to this sort of spiritual, contemplative, allegorical reading that we've been talking about all week is that there is a danger with that too, right? We talked about dangers with Martin Luther's sort of innovations in reading the Bible, his insistence on the singularity of biblical meaning, on relying only on what the sort of the plain sense of what the text is saying. But there's also a danger in moving so far away from the biblical text that they kind of cease to speak in their particularity and cease to call us to look at the particular things that they were originally trying to call us to look at. So a good example of this, and I think it's never a bad thing to think about the parable of the Good Samaritan, because this is obviously one of Jesus's most powerful parables. I'd like to read it, and then I'm going to share with you some ways in which this was interpreted in the Middle Ages that, unless you've actually studied medieval theology, I think is going to be a surprise to you. And in this group, nothing is ever a surprise to the community at Holden Village, it seems like. But I think most Christians today don't think of it the way it was often thought of in the Middle Ages. But would someone be willing to read this very famous parable of the Good Samaritan for us? Can you see that there?
Just then a lawyer stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he said, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" He said to him, "What is written in the law? What do you read there?" He answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You have given the right answer. Do this, and you will live."
And could I ask you to just pause there for 1 second before we go on to the parable? I just think it's interesting, first of all, that this is the parable is told in response to this question that we have been discussing all week long, which is, what does love look like in the world, right? And we saw that Paul, in his letter to the Galatians that we talked about on Wednesday, says you can sum up the entire law in one commandment, which is love your neighbor as yourself. This lawyer here gives two commandments, love God and love people, but it's basically the same idea. We notice then that Paul says, but I can't really tell you more than that. I can tell you you need to love your neighbor, but you now have the freedom to go figure out what that looks like in your time and place. If I try to spell it out, I'm just going to create a new law, right? I'm going to make you slaves or robots rather than making you children of God. And as children of God, you have that freedom. I think it's interesting. Jesus says a lot more about this in this place, but Jesus doesn't spell out, you know, the 15 steps to loving your neighbor either, right? Instead, he tells us this parable. He tells us this story. And it's one of those stories that I think has such power because, you know, every time we read it, we maybe think of it in a different way. We see ourselves in the story in a different way. We hear it calling us to act in a new context in a different way. So, I mean, I think this is one of those places where we should just, before we even read the parable, just reflect to think about why did Jesus choose to teach in parables? Because he could have been a lot more direct. He could have been a lot more blunt. But he says, instead, consider this story. Here's a little story for you about what loving your neighbor means and see what it makes you think about. All right, if you could.
But wanting to justify himself, he asked Jesus, and who is my neighbor? Jesus replied, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers, who stripped him, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road. And when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, while traveling, came near him, and when he saw him, he was moved by pity. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, having poured oil and wine on them. Then he put him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, and said, take care of him, and when I come back, I will repay you whatever more you spend. Which one of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? He said, the one who showed him mercy. Jesus said to him, go and do likewise.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that Jesus ends with a question. He asks the lawyer to think about this story, and then he calls him to action, right? After he's sort of contemplated this story, he says, go and be like that Samaritan. Now, this is a very familiar story, I think, to most of us. It's a kind of favorite story of Christians, and we even have Good Samaritan laws now, right, that protect people who, like, help strangers in need. But this is one of those stories where all of those resources that Martin Luther kind of sowed the seeds for with historical critical interpretation can be useful, because if we know some of the things about the historical context of this parable, it becomes even more powerful. What do you all know about Samaritans and their relationship to Jews in the first century?
Outcasts, outcast, mixed
least
race.
Of the least.
Least of the least? Do you know anything about their history? Like, who would a Samaritan say they were?
Weren't they the ones that were left behind when the second Babylonian exile happened?
Yeah, good. So that's what the Samaritans would say.
Yeah.
In other words, the Samaritans would say they were Israelites who weren't taken into exile in Babylon by the Babylonians, right? So you could see how this would really grate on the Jews or the Israelites who were taken into exile, because they're basically saying, we're better children of God than you are, right? We never left, thank you very much, right? And they worshiped Yahweh. They had their own Pentateuch, in other words, their own first 5 books of the Bible with slight differences. Some of my scholar friends who study the Hebrew Bible, they compare it with the Samaritan Pentateuch. That's way beyond what I'm able to do. But they worship Yahweh. Interestingly, in their version of the Pentateuch, they did not have the commandment, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. So whereas ancient Israelites and still Jews today, they would never pronounce that word YHWH, that we Christians would just say Yahweh, no Jew, no Israelite would ever say that out loud. When they read that on the page, they say Adonai or Lord instead, because no human being has the right to pronounce the name of God from a Israelite or a Jewish perspective. That just wasn't part of Samaritan tradition. So they called God Yahweh all the time. They just said that. And again, boy, did that make the Israelites mad. Boy, did that make the Jews think they were such heretics. The Samaritans also had their own temple on a different mountain about like 30 miles north of Jerusalem, right? So they had their own temple that where they offered their own animal sacrifices to God. And this is something I've always been fascinated with. You know, the second Jewish temple was destroyed in the year 70 in the Jewish-Roman War. So it was destroyed by the Romans. It no longer exists. If you go to Jerusalem today, the Temple Mount is a Muslim holy site today. The Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim, which there are references to in the Gospels, if you next time you notice references to Mount Gerizim, that's where the Samaritan temple is. The Romans didn't care about that. The Samaritans were a tiny little minority. They weren't causing the Romans problems, so they never destroyed the Samaritan temple. I have read, and I don't know this from personal experience, but I have read that there is still, to this day, there's a community of about 1,000 Samaritans who still live in, I don't know, I honestly don't know if it's in Israel or Palestine today, but they still hold rituals on Mount Gerizim, and they still sacrifice animals on Mount Gerizim, and they still celebrate Passover, right? Because they have this same story of Passover that Jews do, and they slaughter a lamb on you know, the first day of Passover the way Jews would if they had a temple, right? But ever since the year 70 when the temple is destroyed, animal sacrifice has not been part of Judaism. I bring all this historical context in just to say Samaritans were a real people, and there were reasons why there was this deep-seated conflict between Jews and Samaritans. It's kind of like sometimes the people you get irritated with the most are your own family, or the people who are kind of like you but not fully like you. They're the ones who really get under your skin, and that's how it was with the Samaritans and the Jews. Now notice here, we have a man who's leaving Jerusalem. I think we can assume this man is Jewish, right? Where is he going? Jericho. And I probably should have put a map on the screen, but I didn't. So I'm just going to show you a map in this Bible here. Let's see if I can find the one I want to look at. All right, so this is Judea and its neighbors in the first century CE. This is not you don't need to be able to see very closely. You see down here the Dead Sea. You see Jerusalem here. And you see Nazareth up here where Jesus was from, right? So the man is leaving Jerusalem. I think we can assume that he's probably going to where there are other Jews, which would be the area up here around the Sea of Galilee. And I'm not creating this interpretation myself. This is what biblical scholars with a lot more historical knowledge than I would suggest. So we can probably assume that he's going up in the direction of Nazareth. The most straightforward direction for him to go then would be to simply go due north, right? However, Jericho, where he says he's going, is way off here to the east. Why would he be taking this detour, going through Jericho, crossing the Jordan River, going on the other side of the Jordan River, and then looping back to go to the area around the Sea of Galilee? What's he avoiding?
Samaria.
Yeah, he's taking a long route because he doesn't want to come into contact with those Samaritans, right? They'll make him dirty. They'll make him unholy. They'll really get under his skin. So he has done everything he can to avoid coming into conflict or contact with the Samaritans, right? So the fact that he's going from Jerusalem to Jericho, if we know a little bit about the geography, if we know a little bit about the history of this road, scholars of the New Testament, which I am not, but they teach me that this road was famous as the way, the detour that allowed Jews to not have to come into contact with Samaritans, right? That's why the road was built, basically. So we have this Jew who has done everything possible not to come into contact with Samaritans, and yet who does Jesus make the hero of this story? Not the priest, not the Levite, but the Samaritan. I often think that, you know, this would be a very sweet, very nice story if this was a story about a Jew helping a Samaritan who was hurt by the side of the road. How nice would that be? You know, if you want to know what love is like, imagine helping a Samaritan. That's what love is like. Love even those people. Love the Samaritans, right? But one of the things that is so powerful about this parable is that it makes the outsider, the Samaritan, the hero of the story, right? It doesn't make the Samaritan or the outsider the victim. It makes them the hero. So in a way, it's sort of, for me, it's like it's not just a parable that's about love, but it's a parable that's loving in the way it's told, right? Because it gives that Samaritan the place of honor, the place of the hero role in the story, so that we remember this as the story of the Good Samaritan. One last question. So the priest and the Levite, and for our purposes, they're both basically priests. They're sort of like a first-class priest and then the second-class priest, who's the Levite. They both pass him by. They're coming up from Jericho towards Jerusalem. Where would you assume they're going?
To the temple.
Yeah, they're going to worship God. Right? They're going to offer sacrifices to God. They're going to pray. Of course they can't be bothered by this man on the side of the road. They have to go serve God. Right? And one of the things that I think Jesus is teaching us in this parable is, if your love for God leads you to pass by human beings in need, you're not really loving God. Or there's something really wrong with how you're loving God. Right? Remember, here it's in the mouth of this lawyer, but this is a definition of love that we get so many times in the Bible. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. But it's if loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength leads you not to love your neighbor, you're doing something wrong. You're not really loving God, right? Loving God and loving your neighbor turn out to be basically the same thing. And we saw, as I said, in the letter to the Galatians, that when Paul summarizes the whole law, he leaves God out entirely. He just says the whole law is summed up as love your neighbor as yourself, right? So for me, especially as someone who spends my days teaching theology, the idea that the two sort of bad guys in this story, the priest and the Levite, they're going to do a good work, right? They're going, it's like they got to catch the boat to Holden Village, right? And yet it leads them to neglect the person right in front of them who's in need. So I want to talk more about this parable in a second. I'm actually going to ask you all to think about how you might retell this story in a contemporary context. Like, who would you put in the place of the Samaritan? Who would you put in the place of the priest or the Levite if you were to tell this story to, say, a Sunday school group or to your congregation today? But before we do that, I wanted to show you the way this story was often interpreted in the Middle Ages. And to help me do this, I'm going to show you a window from this cathedral in France where it presents this allegorical interpretation of the parable. Has anyone been to Chartres Cathedral in France? A few of you, yeah. It's a very famous cathedral. And it's famous for a lot of things. It's famous for the organ. It's famous for the labyrinth that's on the floor. And it's also famous for the stained glass windows. And the blue in the stained glass windows is even this particular shade of blue in like art history is known as Chartres blue because just getting that pigment was something that really had never been done before. And it's a really unique shade of blue, especially at this point in history. So all of the windows in this cathedral tell Bible stories. And one of the interesting things about them is they usually juxtapose Bible stories together. They combine them in a way that gives a kind of dogmatic or didactic teaching. And I'm not an expert in these windows, but I do know enough to sort of explicate what's going on in this one. Does anybody know how you go about reading the windows? Because it's a very specific system. So you basically read it like a book. In other words, you go left to right, and then you just go up, and you just keep going left to right and up. Notice what you're doing, though, and this is sort of the function of the entire space of the cathedral itself. You're going from the ground, and you're looking farther and farther and farther and farther up to heaven, right? And by the end of the window, you'll get the most abstract and most spiritual and sort of most allegorical meaning that you can find in this parable. So we're going to start at the bottom here. This actually has nothing to do with the parable. Can you tell what's going on there? Can you tell what they're... They're making shoes, yep. And it was the shoemakers who donated money for this window. Oh. So this is their little, call out here. So now we start with the story of the Good Samaritan. So this is Jesus speaking to the lawyer and the Pharisee. He's about to tell them the parable. And I'm just going to summarize for you the basic allegorical interpretation here that this window is going to promote. This is everywhere in the Middle Ages. Everyone interprets the story in this allegorical way, and in fact, even though Martin Luther says he's against allegory, when he interprets the parable of the Good Samaritan, he's going to interpret it this way because it seems so obvious to him, he thinks it's the literal meaning. According to this way of reading the parable, this Jewish man who leaves Jerusalem behind, who goes out from the city, it's like Adam and Eve leaving the Garden of Eden, right? It's like human beings falling into sin, being beset by the devil, being beset by sin by the side of the road, being beaten, robbed, left for dead. And then who should come along but the Good Samaritan, who is Jesus, right? Who pours oil and wine on the wounds. I think that makes the medieval church think of sacraments, right? Like wine of Holy Communion, the oil of anointing. So Jesus heals the wounds, puts the man on his own animal, takes him to the inn, which is the church, right? And says to the innkeeper, whatever debts this man incurs, put them all on my account, right? Which sounds like Jesus paying for our sins, essentially, right? So that's the interpretation of this story that this window is going to be promoting. So we see here, Jesus is telling the parable, the man is leaving Jerusalem, you see the robber with the giant sword there, he's attacking the man, his shirt's getting pulled off, again, being beaten, and we keep going up the window here, don't want to lose my place, so keep going up the window. Now we've got Jesus, the Good Samaritan, caring for the man, bandaging his wounds. And now all of a sudden, very next window, right here, we're in the Garden of Eden. God is creating Adam. God's breathing life into Adam. Here's Adam in the garden. Can you tell what's going on here? Eve is being created,
yeah.
Right. And then God is telling Adam and Eve not to eat from the tree of forbidden fruit. Let's see, I went the wrong way again. All right. And then finally, God is, yeah, God's banishing them. I think we missed the one where they do eat from the tree of the forbidden tree. God is sending them away, casting them out. Then we get a couple more stories of them being told they're going to have to work for their living, that Eve is going to have pain in childbirth. Then we have the story of Cain and Abel. And then the last window, the very pinnacle of the window when you're looking up to heaven, is God on the last day welcoming everyone back into paradise. Right? So, the whole point here is to read the story of the Good Samaritan in line with basically the story of the human race, right? I'm the person who goes out from Jerusalem. I'm the person who has fallen into the hands of robbers, into sin, and I'm the one who is healed and redeemed and paid for by the Samaritan, Jesus. How do you react to this story? Do you find, is there value there? What dangers do you see? Does anybody feel like they can relate to this parable better, or they see a new dimension of this parable?
I would feel less responsible. I feel less responsible for taking care of the Samaritan. In reverse, being the Samaritan and taking care of the
food. Right. So I think that normally, I assume that most of us, when we read this, we feel called to be like the Samaritan. Mm-hmm. But when we read it in this light, we feel called to see ourselves as the victim who is cared for by the Samaritan, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe that, there may be times where that's a valuable way to read it, right? I mean, I think about the parable of the prodigal son, for example. That's one where every time I hear it, I'm a different person in the story, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm the prodigal son, sometimes I'm the elder brother, sometimes I'm called to be the father, right? And maybe there's not one right answer, and maybe there doesn't have to be here, but there is a danger there, right? That if we get so fixated on the way God is going to redeem everyone because Jesus was the real good Samaritan, we kind of do lose that ethical call to actually care for the people lying by the side of the road before our eyes.
Well, haven't you known, and maybe they're not super serious when they say it, but they say, I can do whatever I want as long as I ask for forgiveness before I die.
Uh-huh.
You know, I can be, and that's more like when you're younger, but I've heard people say that.
Yeah, I have too. Good. Any other thoughts?
Well, it's not common that we think ourselves as the victim.
Uh-huh.
So this window does bring that opportunity to enter into that reality.
Mm-hmm.
We're often the one from our culture, the one who can serve or called to serve.
Right.
But to be served by another, that mm-hmm. that takes humility, mm-hmm. takes openness, takes, you know, willingness to be served.
And right. And to see God as a person who, like, maybe it does help us to understand God better, right? Like, God was the one who first entered human life to the point of showing us what it means to be a servant, right? But, yeah, if we stop there, and we realize that we're then called to go out and serve others ourselves, that's the problem, right? So I certainly wouldn't want to say that this way of interpreting the parable is inherently bad or evil, but as with so many things we've talked about this week, the danger comes when we think, I've got the story figured out, right? I finally understood the one true meaning of the story, right? That's perhaps the danger represented by this window. And remember when we looked at what Martin Luther said about allegory on Wednesday? What he was most concerned about was that allegorical readings of Scripture were just substituting one kind of literal meaning of the parable for another. It's not really about you being called to go serve your neighbor. It's actually about the fact that believe Jesus is your good Samaritan who binds your wounds and takes you to the church to be cared for, right? And what I've been encouraging us to think about all week long is maybe the Bible is most effective when these meanings are constantly multiplying. When the more we contemplate it, the more we see, and the more people we realize we're called to see and to serve in our lives. So I thought we could just take a couple of minutes here, and if you could just talk with people in your groups. If you were to retell this story today, especially now knowing what you know about the historical context of the parable of the Good Samaritan, who Samaritans were, what the road to Jericho was used for, how could you tell this in a sort of 2018 version? Who would be the characters? What would be the places? What would be done in the story. So if you could just turn to two or three or four people around you and just sort of reflect on that for a couple of minutes, then we'll listen to one more song from Considering Matthew Shepard. People, we don't, there are maybe 1,000 Samaritans left in the world today, and they're all somewhere in Israel, Palestine. So how would we tell this story for our context today? Anything interesting that you talked about? Yeah.
We talked about the Samaritan being an illegal immigrant, mm-hmm. and that image of the road being consistent with that.
Wow. Yeah.
And that perhaps the Levite would be, I don't know, maybe an ICE agent, but the priest would be a senator.
Mm.
So that's ran fully defined victim.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, it's good, and I like you chose there to have the undocumented person, again, be the sort of hero in the story, right? Helping maybe an ICE agent, which is interesting. Yeah.
Well, our story was not as well-developed, but for me, the Good Samaritan would be probably somebody in the NRA that I would see it have very different values than I, but that person being... in that rescuing role.
Right. So for many of us at Holden Village, it might be people who sort of are not progressive in the way we like to think we are, right? We're called to love everyone, including people in the NRA, as you say. Good. Anyone else?
Years ago, I was on that road from Jericho up to Jerusalem, and there's an inn of the Good Samaritan on that road, and then you go in there and you can act it out.
Uh-huh.
That was fun. Somebody's the donkey and somebody's a tree. So you're really acting it out.
It's
real.
That's a way to make it alive today, for sure.
Yeah. There was an end to that story that was really nice about when she did act it out.
The guides wanted to be who was Muslim. He wanted to be Jesus in it with us.
Wow.
With the Samaritan.
Yeah.
How cool.
Yeah, meet the Samaritan.
That's a nice image to have in your mind. So I see a hand here and then one over there. Yeah.
Somebody in our group said that maybe the Samaritan was a group of, you know, fundamentalist Christians or people who interpret the Bible differently than we do. Mm-hmm. We think it's wrong and right-wing and all that.
Right.
And then I realized, oh my gosh, I've had this experience that I have a family member who struggles with addictions, and they're being cared for right now by a group of what I considered and had a label towards them as fundamentalist, charismatic type Christians. And when I actually had an experience and met them and saw how beautifully they were caring for this family member,
Yeah, suddenly you can't just label them, write them off as people who are wrong, but they're actually loving. Yeah.
Opened my eyes, actually.
Yeah.
Good. And then my question was, okay, so then in this parable, who am I?
Mm.
As, and it's not necessarily like I passed by caring for this family member, but so who am I? I'm not sure. I have to think about that.
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing to contemplate.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Was there another hand over here?
I just had, when I was a Samaritan, and when someone would be a Samaritan to me.
Yeah, tell us about that.
I look back, all the people that have been that to you. Mm-hmm. You haven't stopped to
view
who they were.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I do think that for us reading this parable today, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but most of us hear it primarily as a call to be like the Good Samaritan, but what I hear you saying is it's also worth thinking about the people who have been that Samaritan to us and to have gratitude to them and to say thank you to them. Excellent. Yeah.
I don't know if I can say this right, but we were talking about how the parents of the children who are being taken away, they're being stripped and so on.
Right.
I didn't say it exactly like that, but that's kind of the way it came out. And so it kind of turns out that the rest of us are just kind of those that walk by.
Mm.
If we don't do something about this, we are the ones that are walking by, because those parents are...
Right.
They're helpless.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah, well, I want to conclude now with one final piece from Considering Matthew Shepard, but I think you guys have all done such a wonderful job of showing the ways in which when we contemplate these stories, we don't just sort of like raise our eyes to one single meaning that explains everything, but we kind of see so many different facets of the Bible, so many different ways it speaks to us at different moments and different times in our lives, and also calls us to go forth and act in the world in different ways. And as Paul says, we have the freedom then to figure out what God's love looks like in a specific circumstance that we're facing. So we won't have just a whole lot of time to discuss this song. It's about 4 minutes. It's, for me, it's just one of the most beautiful songs in Considering Matthew Shepard. It's near the end. Just want to make sure I hit the right track here. And there's definitely some pretty clear, if implicit, imagery of the cross in this song that I think is just so powerful.
Worthy, O
you'll have to listen to the end of this
piece for yourself, because obviously it's very beautiful. That's basically our time for today. I would be interested if anyone has just like any things they'll be kind of taking away from this class, sort of down the mountain, so to speak, as you go on to read the Bible and try to build up God's love in the world.
How much light can you bear?
Mm. Say a little bit more about that.
Sometimes situations like this become very bright, and you have to come out of the shadows and see what's going on. Mm. And to see the full light, you have to be what you're called to be. That's love your neighbor.
Mm. Beautifully said. Amen. Well, thank you to all of you for being here. It's been a pleasure to be with you all, and I hope this will bring some new perspectives to how we all look at the Bible as we go forth from here. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.